Yeah, howdy. It's Truth About Markets London, 104.4 Residence, FM, Max and Stacy. How's it going, Stacy?
Oh, it's going pretty well. We're recording on this new device here, and I'm trying to see how to check the levels. But yeah, it's going pretty well, Max Kaiser.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, it's an old device, actually. It's the Eaterall. We used to do this one a couple of years ago.
That's right. That's right.
Our famous radio shows from the street.
From the street, yep. That's what we were doing. And mm-hmm. So anyway, Max,
yeah.
Gold hitting new all-time highs daily.
Oh, yeah, gold, yeah. Well, before we talk about gold, it's interesting. You have over there in Ireland, the government is issuing bonds, and it's similar around the world. You see, the UK and the Ireland and America, everyone is issuing bonds. The governments are issuing bonds, while at the same time they are buying the bonds.
That doesn't sound right. It would be like being a maker of shoes, and if I were Nike Corporation or Joe Bag of Donuts down the street making shoes, and then I kept selling them to myself, I probably wouldn't really be making much of a profit, even if I marked them up really high.
Well, yeah. It's like, for example, the New York Times bestseller list. Authors will release a book by the publisher, and then the publisher is the one that buys all the copies.
Yes.
And then they report that it's on the New York Times bestseller list. They don't report that it's the publisher themselves who bought the books to make it so they can carry a headline that, oh, the book is on the bestseller list. Now, the Bank of England, they engage in what they call quantitative easing, which means that they buy back the stuff that they just sold. And then they announced to the world that the auction was a success. Yes, it was a success. The appetite for gilts is high. The appetite for Irish bonds is high. The appetite for U.S. government treasury bonds is high. Oh, yes, well, that's right. They borrowed money. They borrowed more money to buy these bonds, of course. So the overall level of indebtedness keeps going higher.
Yes, I see that. I'm sure the Irish people who listen to the show, and there are many of them, like Gussie and Geek Boy and Dork of Cork, of course.
That's right.
I'm sure they see the debt situation there, because when you have this debt spiral, more and more of the government funds are going to servicing the debt.
That's right.
Meaning less and less for public services, more and more people being laid off, more and more people unemployed, more and more people with no money.
That's right.
And it's a spiral.
That's right. So why are they doing this? Because banks have debts on their balance sheet that they need to roll over. Nobody wants the bank's debts. So the government is stepping in to buy the bank's debts. And they do this by creating more debt and then buying back the debt by printing up more money. As you point out, this is causing the interest on the debt burden to continue to go higher. So more of a percentage of the overall income in economies in the Eurozone, in Ireland, in the UK, in America is going towards servicing the debt, which means that there is no growth. There's no way to increase the capacity of the economy to generate jobs that would generate wages, that would generate savings, that would generate capitalism, that would generate inflation. So we're trapped in a deflationary spiral, and the government's solution to this debt deflation is to increase the debt. And so clearly that is insane, but they do it because they've got a gun to their head pointed at them by the banks. Now, there's a story that has been going around since 2008 that we had no choice. We had to bail out the bankers. That's a story that was written by the bankers. Now, it's not true. It's false. The government could have very easily done a number of things starting in 2008 that would have alleviated the crisis, and it would have been highly beneficial to the overall economy. But they chose the course of action that was presented to them by the bankers at the point of a gun. And quite literally in the United States, the Congress was told that martial law would be declared if Goldman Sachs and Hank Paulson did not get the $750 billion that they were extorting from Congress at the end of 2008. Then Obama came into office and he continued the charade and has made the situation a lot worse. But that's a false premise that they had no choice, that they had to bail out the banks. Speaking of bailing out the banks, we had a comment made by Warren Buffett's number two man, Charlie Munger.
Charlie Munger. And remember, Warren Buffett had a seat at the table while this crisis was going on. He was the guy that the government went to trying to help bail out some of the banks. He helped bail out Goldman Sachs. Well, Charlie Munger said, thank God that the bank bailouts happened, and thank God they weren't extended to the people. But one of the things he said in this discussion in front of some students was that if the government hadn't come in and rescued the banks, this is why he's saying it's so much better than rescuing the people, is that we would have had another Hitler. So Lord knows what Hank Paulson was hearing from these bankers he was on the phone with. He himself, of course, is a banker. But they were threatening the government with bringing in another Hitler.
Right. So Charlie Munger. Now, remember, okay, he's the number two guy at Berkshire Hathaway. He basically is Warren Buffett's buddy. He just hangs out in the office. He adds nothing to Berkshire Hathaway. And we'll be spit rotisserie Charlie Munger on next week's Kaiser Report and taking him, you know, apart limb by limb in most glorious fashion. But you make sure you watch that show. But basically, remember that Berkshire Hathaway, of course, is a huge owner of Wells Fargo Bank, and Wells Fargo bought Wachovia Bank, and Wachovia admitted and paid a fine for engaging in multi-hundred billion dollar money laundering operation for Mexican drug cartels. So by a simple two or three steps removed, Charlie Munger is a drug launderer for Mexican drug cartels, and he's defending that as a necessity to keep the system liquid, or there would have been the rise of another Hitler. Now, he is, in fact, subsidizing and feathering the nests of the Mexican drug cartels and the failed narco state, thanks to folks like Charlie Munger, who, by the way, they're down there in Omaha, Nebraska. That's not far from that that South United States, North United States, fake Mexican border. So does a Mexican drug cartel leader have a gun to Charlie Munger's head and says, either you make up this nonsense and spew it out of your third orifice, you incontinent old slob, or we're going to splatter your brains out on the pavement?
Well, Charlie Munger is the 230th richest man in America, I guess. He has $1.9 billion in Berkshire shares.
Yeah, because he got paid in Berkshire shares instead of the minimum wage that he was making as a greeter at Walmart.
Uh-huh.
Okay, now he's a rich guy, but he's got no skills of his own other than he can keep Warren Buffett amused. He's basically the equivalent of a fluffer on a porn set.
Actually, he's on the board of directors of Costco, I think the article said when I was reading about this. So he's also against the notion... He's all for the Costco Walmart model too. He was talking about how much this is better. They could deal with everything.
Well, it's often the case when psychopaths, always like we talk about it here on the Norman Bates syndrome. Mm. They look in the mirror and they say that man in the mirror is a dangerous man. We need to stop him. Now Charlie Munger has looked in the mirror and seen Hitler. And he's alerting the world that Hitler needs to be stopped. Let's understand, though, that he's talking about himself. And, of course, the people in retrospect wish that they had stopped Hitler earlier in his career as a despot. Well, let's take a page from that experience and stop Charlie Munger.
Well, of course, Hitler was financed by a lot of the big bankers on Wall Street, just as they're apparently they have all these Hitlers in waiting.
Yeah. Well, of course, including the Vatican. And the Vatican is back in the news, of course, the massive money laundering scam that is the Vatican. So the Pope is really having a tough year this year, segueing into a massive money laundering scam at the Vatican. Vatican bankers and laundering inquiry. Police seize 23 million euros of the Holy See's assets. Money transfers at the center of an investigation. So the Italian police have confirmed that the Vatican is once again in hot water. And it goes back, of course, to something we've talked about on our show before. Roberto Calvi, the director of Banco Ambrosiano, who was found hanging from Blackfriars Bridge in London in June of 1982 as part of the Vatican's need to borrow some massive amounts of money from the mafia at that time due to meet a liquidity squeeze.
No, they had to pay back the mafia. They owed the mafia $1 billion because I guess during the 70s they ran into a lot of trouble because of the financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And also that this is before they had gone heavy into opening all sorts of you know churches, places where they could find money in the third world. So, but at the same time, their flock of Europeans were abandoning the church. So anyway, their source of income dried up for that decade, and they went to the mafia apparently. Allegedly, you know, to borrow some money, and they were in hock to them for $1 billion, mm-hmm. and then they couldn't find a way to pay them back. So apparently, the story was that Roberto Calvi was running from bank to bank in the city of London, sweat pouring down his face, begging for $1 billion to borrow. And later that day, he committed suicide by hanging himself on Blackfriars Bridge. His secretary also committed suicide that night by jumping out of a window in, I think it was Milan.
Mm-hmm. Those were the good old days when bankers were bankers, you know, and they didn't get to go to Tony Blair or George Bush or Barack Obama and just get $1 billion on or Chalabi. You know, Chalabi took over Iraq based on a pitch that he could have a self-financing incursion of Iraq, and it would, oh, the revenue, we're going to pay for itself. You know, these days, you know, back in the 80s, of course, things were a lot tougher back then. The mob, of course, was a lot stronger as well. But the Vatican Church calls their bank the Institute for Religious Works, in a bit of newspeak there.
It sounds like this is something you could probably see happening in Wall Street. Sounds like something, what's his name? Who's the head of Goldman Sachs? I can't even think of it. Blankfein. Lloyd Blankfein will call his bank, rename it.
The Goldman Sachs of Religious Works.
Yeah, well, you know, also Charlie Munger saying that he thanks God. God is responsible for bailing out the banks. Not the corrupt politicians.
Everyone's claiming God. You know, the Blankfein says he's doing God's work. The Pope thinks he's doing God's work. Bin Laden thinks he's doing God's work. I mean, they can't all be doing God's work. Somebody's got to be wrong in this equation, or they're all wrong, which I believe is the case here. The Vatican doesn't work for God. God is not happy with the Vatican, hasn't been happy with the Vatican for 1600
years.
You know, I mean, it went way off the rails back in the first century A.D., didn't it? Then you have Bin Laden, of course, is not doing God's work. He's doing the work of the Bin Laden Construction Corporation. You knock buildings down, and then you have to contract to build them back up again. If nobody figured that out by now, they've got serious rocks in their head. Then you've got Lloyd Blankfein. He thinks he's doing God's work. Well, he's just a crook, I mean, and a fraudster and a money launderer.
But maybe it's a situation kind of like if you see the Buddha by the side of the road, shoot him.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the same thing here, is if somebody says they're doing God's work, maybe that's a sure sign that they're not.
Well, certainly the Vatican finds itself once again embroiled in massive scandal. The Institute for Religious Works, or the BOV, they should call it, the Bank of the Vatican. Why don't they just forget all the an attempt to disguise the fact that Vatican's a massive Ponzi scheme, and they go, and the missionaries are the same as derivative salesmen, the analog. You know, derivative salesmen go to pension funds, and they get pension funds to commit all their pension money into a huge pyramid Ponzi scheme to fund the Christmas bonuses at Goldman Sachs, and the Vatican sends its missionaries out to loot and pillage and send the money back to its Ponzi scheme in the Vatican. Now, they say that the Bank of the Vatican, the IOR, they don't publish their accounts, of course, because Christians don't believe in transparency or honesty, apparently. And they say, though, that they hold $5 billion in assets. Now, by my back-of-the-envelope calculations, I think they're off by about $455 billion.
Well, is this the Vatican Bank? I think their situation is such that it's almost set up like the U.S. system. You have the U.S. Federal Reserve, then you have the New York Fed, then the San Francisco Fed, the St. Louis Fed, the Dallas Fed. I think you have the Vatican Bank, to which only the Pope is a shareholder. And then under that, you have a few of these other banks, so that when they get caught money laundering or whatever, it's just these subsidiary banks that get shut down.
Right. So where's this all going to end? Obviously, the Pope was recently in London, and ostensibly to apologize for the kiddie raping scandal. But I think basically he was there more probably to get the hedge funds in London to help him extricate himself from his money laundering scam.
Well, yeah. I mean, the last time we saw, I mean, even these articles point out the last scandal from the Vatican Bank was Roberto Calvi found hanging from Blackfriars Bridge.
Right.
Well, he was there to try to find money to pay off somebody. So who's the Vatican trying to pay off? What's going on? Do they owe some bankers in London some money? Did they borrow money from one of these banks? Did one of these banks blow up that they were heavily behind? Or, you know, we probably won't know. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Well, if God is your counterparty, you're broke. I think that's the lesson there. The Vatican is probably the Bank of the Vatican is a counterparty in a lot of trades that went bust. And now the Vatican finds itself once again broke. And there they are in London, parading around in all the regalia, trying to raise a quick $20 or $30 or $40 billion probably to pay off some short-term paper. And, you know, because the shakedown that happens every Sunday morning isn't bringing in the coins fast enough. I mean, what they need over there is for Jesus Christ to come back and declare a debt jubilee. Isn't that in the frickin' Bible? Debt jubilee? Why can't the Vatican convince the world to engage in a debt jubilee? Forgive the debts. Forgive. Isn't that part of Christianity to forgive? Well, forgive the debts.
No, he's too concerned about prophylactics. That's all he seems to care.
He needs a monetary prophylactic to stop him from spreading his bad debt seed into the various countries around the world that gives birth to more debt.
Well, what else is happening, Max Kaiser?
Well, apparently you've got...
Speaking of bankers doing God's work, did you see Larry Summers has announced he's leaving the White House?
Yeah, he's going to be joining Eric Prince over there in the United Arab Emirates, an extradition-free zone. I told you, they're all going to end up there. Larry Summers. First it's Eric Prince, then Larry Summers. Then Geithner will be over there, Greenspan, Bernanke. Obama will join them in a couple of years when he gets booted out of office.
Oh, I see. He's returning to Harvard. Well, yeah, because they he did such a good job blowing up their fund.
Yeah, their fund had the worst performance in its history under the stewardship of Larry Toptic Summers. So that's you going back there to finish that institution off.
Well, that's good. So who's going to replace him, though? Like, I mean,
he's the what? The economic advisor?
Yeah, the head of the economic advisors.
Uh-huh.
So who are they going to replace him with? He was the top economic advisor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to need some academic idiot, probably Paul Krugman.
No.
No?
No way. Of course they can't do that because Fox News would go crazy.
Well, why? He's a conservative guy. He's not liberal. Paul Krugman, he's down with the program. He believes in all of the...
But the population itself, you've got the Wizard of Oz there, man. You've got Rupert Murdoch. Whatever he says, the population of America believes.
Well, Larry Summers, of course, he's leaving. His job is complete. He was able to maintain the Bush policies and the Clinton policies and the Rob Rubin policies, the Goldman Sachs policies. You know, he succeeded. He got a totally compromised Obama. He killed Obama's place in history. He destroyed Obama's legitimacy. So he can leave. His job is done. That leaves Geithner and a couple of other folks. But who will take his place in the round table of idiots is still an open-ended question. Any other ideas?
Oh, of course, you know, when he returns to Harvard, you know who's there as well is Tony Blair as a lecturer. Not Tony Blair. Gordon Brown is now going to be a lecturer there. Tony Blair is at Yale.
Oh, now let's talk about gold, because, of course, Gordon Brown famously sold half of Britain's gold at the low, multi-decade low in the $250-$260 per dollar an ounce range a few years back. It was the absolute worst trade of the millennium. And now with gold skyrocketing, the amount that this is costing UK taxpayers is enormous. I mean, imagine if, you know, the UK banks are saying, oh, you know, we need to increase our reserve requirements. We need to do it maybe even more than what the recent Basel Accord is suggesting. Well, too bad you sold half of your gold at the low for the millennium. And now, of course, you don't have any reserves, just like you don't have any oil reserves either. You know, you should stop drinking yourself into a coma and throwing away all of your oil and gold. I think that would be a good first step, Britain.
Thatcher presided over the selling of most of the oil at, you know, 100-year lows as well.
Yeah, right. So what are they going to sell next? I mean, they need to raise some cash to pay their drug and alcohol debts. And all their bad investment debts. I mean, what's left? I mean, the crown jewels, obviously, I've been saying for years, I think those should be sold. You can get a pretty penny for the crown and the scepter and the orb and the, what is that orb thing that she carries around with?
Yeah, they should sell off the monarchy. And then that's when you know that they'll officially bring back monarchies. Because I feel like the U.S. is itching to have just a king or you know, royal family.
Larry Ellison would be happy to buy the British royal monarchy. You know, he's one of the top five richest guys in the world. I'm sure he could buy the entire thing for $60 or $70 billion. He can do a leverage buyout, you know, raise another, whatever it takes to buy it out.
And I think they could get it cheaper than that.
You think so?
Yeah.
Well, very well then. And use that money to buttress the banking system with some increased reserves. But, I mean, what else could they sell? I mean, they should just give up Northern Ireland, I think. Sell it to Ireland proper. Why don't they let Ireland do a leverage buyout and reunify with Northern Ireland as a way to pay down some of the debts that they owe the global banking system? This way, you've made peace. You've given Ireland what it wants. Same thing for Scotland. Let Scotland buy themselves out from the British, Empire. The United Kingdom, right? They should just go back to England, and that's all they need. They just need one little country. They can keep their monarchy. They can keep Jeremy Paxman, the Rottweiler of BBC, making driveling nonsense every night over there at Nightline or whatever the show is called, Nightlife or Night Moves or Night Scope or, you know, Night Blindness, I think is what they should call that show. And they'd be happy forever after. Just keep it small. Think small. Think smaller, you know, and you'll do better.
Well, yeah, I mean, those two things they could buy are the monarchy. They could also buy the Vatican. You know, there's a steady income stream in those mm-hmm. two places, like the, what you charge tourists to go into the Tower of London for the monarchy and what you charge, parishioners on Sunday to say that, you know, I don't pretend that they're going to be float up to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there's a steady income stream that you can collateralize and, you know, get it to do a hostile takeover. I want to see a hostile takeover of the Vatican. That would be pretty funny.
Yeah, I'd like to see that as well. And given the current state of the global finances, I think we're going to see something like that. You know what I find, speaking of positive income streams, you know what I don't like are negative income streams. Now, the BBC licensing fee that all people in the Isles, the British Isles, and associated properties and various kerplunked territories must give the Westminster some coin, a few quid every year. Now, why does the BBC feel it is necessary to produce the most hideous piece of propaganda that I've seen in many a year? They put on their television network a show about the glorious Vatican, featuring the Pope and a little boy who was a you know, a, what do you call him there? The altar boy.
Altar boy.
Who is a young Italian altar boy, and he's studying at the Vatican, and his observations about the how great it is and how sincere the Pope is. And they put this on TV during the Pope's kiddie rape scandal period, and they want us to – it's outright propaganda. Now, you would think the BBC would be more sensitive to what propaganda can do to a country after their experiences, of certainly in World War II. So here you have the BBC making propaganda films for the Vatican, using the money from the licensee to put the slop on their television network. I mean, that's a negative income stream. That's unconscionable. And when Rupert Murdoch criticized the BBC as a horrible waste of money and time, you know, you kind of cringe and say, well, Murdoch is the Antichrist, and, you know, you don't want to believe a thing he says. But, you know, occasionally the BBC makes such a dunderheaded, misguided call, judgment call, by kowtowing to the evilness that is the Vatican. And putting out this propaganda piece, it just makes you want to vomit.
Well, let's move back to the U.S. and some stories there from finance and markets and political scandal. Rahm Emanuel cheers drone attacks, according to new Bob Woodward book. He says, yes, who do we get today? So he's the cheerleader for the military-industrial complex, which either both parties are part of the military-industrial complex. One, the base, I guess, is a little bit less inclined to they pretend they're less against war, but kind of like the way that Bob Geldof and Bono are against exploitation of Africa. And, yeah, so here we have this. It's funny because this whole sort of Orwellian warfare state happens so easily. You would have thought, I guess one assumes that your own population, your compatriots, people you know, they're not going to be like that. They're not just going to accept it. But nobody seems to care about this video game sort of dropping bombs from 30,000 feet in the air onto just dots on a screen that nobody knows and nobody cares. And we just say, oh, those are bad guys we killed.
Mm.
And it's just nobody seems to care. Very few people, you know, maybe 1,000 people in America, a country of 330 million people.
Well, in a deflationary environment that we have now, there's less money to go around. So people understand that some people are going to have to die. So when these drones kill folks, like the U.S. is killing innocent Pakistani civilians with drone attacks, the people instinctively know that this means that they get a bigger piece of the pie. Because it's a zero-sum game, and if your government is out there murdering people, that's less people it's going to drain on the system. Goes back to the old Malthusian economics of diminished returns as the population expands. And in a deflationary environment, that's the go-to economic theory. And so people applaud drone attacks, as you would animals in the jungle would applaud the locusts getting wiped out to save the crop of corn to feed the babies for some species, you see. So it's all very it's a turnover. It's a major turnover in history where the survivors of the population are rooting for the destruction of as many of their fellow humans as possible. You've got in the USA, they turn it into a sport. They turn it into a business. You can buy, of course, death and destruction on the New York Stock Exchange. You can participate that way. As I've often said, if Hitler were alive today and he took Auschwitz public on the New York Stock Exchange, many Americans and British people would be anxiously buying stock in that company as a way to profit from the devastation. Of course, you can buy shares in another company now called Corrections Corporation of America. It's up 10 or 15% in the last 2 months. It's basically in the concentration camp rape and torture business. You can participate that way. So it makes sense that the drone attacks are being monetized both as entertainment, as a response to the deflationary environment, as a way to secure votes from sadists who are pretty much the main a driving force in politics around the world today. And it brings me to the Tea Party.
Go ahead. We're waiting anxiously. We're sitting here with our bated breath saying, wow, Max Keiser's about to start speaking about the Tea Party. What's going on?
Well, the Tea Party is a special is a group, is the newest generation of folks who are looking to sell out to some special interest group. That's what the Tea Party is all about. In other words, before 10 years ago and 15 years ago, the generation active in the U.S. sold themselves out to the banking industry, and you had this huge run on the banks. And those people, the yuppie generation, are known for this. The Tea Party party is the latest incarnation of the yuppies. It's the spawn of the yuppies. Now, they're looking for a special interest group to sell out to. And right now, it looks like the corporations that will win in the bid to buy the Tea Party are the telecommunications company, because they've gotten the Tea Party to lobby against net neutrality, which, of course, any sentient human being would be for net neutrality. Any politically active mind that believed in any kind of rule of law or any kind of justice in any kind of civilized system would be for net neutrality. The Tea Party, of course, is not about any kind of civilizing political influence. They're all about, you know, we're a new generation of yuppies, and we'll sell out to the highest bidder. And so all these placard waving and all this marching around is just an advertisement to try to buy us out. You know, we're going to the highest bidder. And I think the telecom companies are the company that will win. And I think this Tea Party group will all grow up to be basically in the surveillance business, just like my generation grew up to be in the banking business. So the surveillance business and the business of telecommunications and everything that comes with it will be the biggest driving money-making force of this Tea Party generation.
Well, from what I see, I mean, the first few months, they seem to be a group that was against, bailouts and, fiscal insanity that ensued after the collapse of the financial system. But they seem more and more now, everything I see pretty much has taken on a very religious tone. They claim they're against a big government, and yet they're also all for criminalizing abortion, criminalizing being gay, like the Republican Party in what Montana just now is. They're against gay people. They want to make it a criminal act. All of that required to criminalize something requires a state to enforce the law. And they're also all for, you know, if you look at Palin or Christine O'Donnell, who are the two, figureheads for the Tea Party, onto which they project a lot of their sexual anxiety, is that they're both for invading Iran.
Yeah.
Well, where do they think the money comes from to invade a war-free state? It doesn't matter. You still have to tax people. Just because they prefer to kill foreigners with their money and another side likes to help poor people in their own country with the money, both sides require taxing the population.
Well, at the core, the Tea Party is retarded. And it goes back to Ronald Reagan, who in his dotage, in his demented later stages of his mental illness, convinced America that he was cutting taxes, while simultaneously, for every dollar he ostensibly cut in taxes, he increased spending by $2 or $3.
Yeah.
The net result of this, of course, is increased taxes, you see. And he drove home the illusion that the debts that were accumulating on the balance sheet of America didn't exist and they would never have to be paid for. And the result today is this massive deflationary spiral and social dislocation and return of America to a proto pre-democratic state of lifelessness and quasi-fascism. And the Tea Party fits right into that trend. They believe that debts don't matter, that they can do whatever they want to do. No taxes are necessary. They can spend money without having any money It's just a matter of spending. The only problem is to spend. They don't make the equation that you have to earn, save first before you can spend. And this is why when countries around the world, in Asia in particular, are dumping the dollar and there's a currency war going on where the dollar is in the crosshairs, you have to root for these other countries because I can't imagine any other country doing a worse job of being a steward for global finance than the United States. I'd rather have Bangladesh run America's and the world's banking system, or Tibet, or China, or India.
Anybody who runs is going to become a maniac. That it gives you, maybe the first few weeks you might be like well-meaning, but as soon as you get it, you're corrupt. But the other thing about the Tea Party thing is they say they're all fiscal conservative and against government spending, but. This never becomes part of the major discourse in the U.S., but look at the federal income taxes paid by each state and look how much they get back from the government federal subsidies. Now, the bottom of the list is Connecticut. Connecticut sends a dollar to the federal government. They get back 80 cents in federal subsidies and various things that get spent in the state. All of the Tea Party states, the entire Midwest and the South, but Alaska's number one, gets $3 from $2 to $4 back for every dollar they send to Washington. So now a lot of that is military spending. But that's why they're all for warfare states. They pretend that they're against federal spending, and they pretend to exclude military spending conveniently for them because that's where they collect all their welfare from.
Right. And of course, Alaska is where Sarah Palin is from.
Yes.
So Sarah Palin comes from Alaska, the state that gets the most dollars back in federal subsidies if you compare it to the amount of money they're actually paying in to the federal coffers.
Yes.
So she believes herself to be a genius because she is a welfare bum. She's getting back an enormous amount of money in her state, but she has personalized this and decided it's her individual genius of running the economy of that state into the ground that qualifies her to take the reins of the entire country as a whole and to try to run that country into the ground as well. See, this is an example of a woman who has fallen in love with the smell of her own flatulence. In other words, she puts out a waste product, which is her flatulence. To most people in the room, that would be offensive. But to her, that's her oxygen. She believes it is nourishing in some way to feed her own delusions, to continue this charade that taking money for nothing and accumulating huge debt is somehow an economic program. And she wants to take that national. And she wants to take all of her acolytes with her, like these other very intellectually challenged people that are filling the so-called Tea Party, begging some industry or corporation to buy them out and to put forward even more retrograde policies that are going to imprison and disenfranchise the majority even worse than they already are.
Hey, speaking of this country of America where there's just so much hatred, there's so much money if you're going to kill people or deprive them of their liberty in some other way, like imprisoning. And I was reading the newspaper this morning in France, and they were talking about this case of some black guy in the banlieues here north of Paris who had killed an Arab youth, North African guy, 2 years ago, and this was four years ago, this was the famous moment when Sarkozy said he was going to clean the streets of the scum in the banlieues. So he's just been sentenced to 8 or 9 years for the murder of this other kid, and which the papers are like, this is the high end. He was facing 6 to 9 years. And then there was another story about these two guys who were captured having stolen a Picasso. And they were both just sentenced to a year in prison. They each got a year. And you just think of the difference between here and the U.S. with these extreme sentences. Like, remember those environmentalists? I know they don't get talked about in the U.S. there because many people are all for, you know, locking up and murdering and killing environmentalists. But those environmentalist kids in Oregon, they burnt down some building or something, and they got 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then there's a story this week from Virginia where they executed in the first woman since 1912. She's right on the border of mental retardation. She has an IQ of 70, and she had murdered her husband and her stepson. But it's just so amazing this sort of different sort of the spiral of hate also. Is a part of the deflationary spiral. It's a spiral that people in America don't seem to be able to get out of. But I think, like, the Spanish were pretty crazy like that and liked killing a lot of people. So did the Romans. I think extreme empire kind of does that to you. It makes you a very hateful sort of person.
Well, plus, as the wealthy now are walking away with all the ill-gotten gains that they stole during the past 25-year bull market, what they're leaving in their place are these robots and drones and algorithmic traders. So, in other words, in the military, they don't want to spend any time actually doing their job in the military as such, strategizing and planning and figuring out what the defense needs are and what the needs are for troops overseas. So they simply set the computer to send drones in and murder people indiscriminately. This gives them time for a nice long 3-martini lunch and a back rub and maybe 9 holes of golf before heading off to their yacht for the weekend. In finance, of course, the traders on Wall Street don't actually do any trading anymore themselves. They don't look at reports or try to analyze anything. They just set their computers to steal. High-frequency trading and co-locating servers next to the New York Stock Exchange, as Goldman Sachs does, siphons cash from the exchange and robs the public of money. And they put that money into their pocket, and they call that work. So, again, it's all been outsourced to automatic droning or automatic trading, high-frequency trading, algorithmic trading. And in the case of justice, because it's managed by effectively the prison system, and the prison system is run by computers and algorithms that simply are set to enact laws mechanically to put as many people into the sausage factory as possible. That's exactly what happens. Nobody's actually running the show there. So you just end up basically with a machine. The machines are winning. You know, not to overuse the metaphor of the Matrix, the film, but it's similar to this. We are becoming the batteries to feed the machines. The machines are now running the show. They are programmed to simply rape, murder, pillage, steal, and deny people of their freedom. That's what the machines are programmed to do. And I'm looking at a story here in the Financial Times. It's another one of these puff pieces by Sebastian Malaby in praise of robo-traders. So here you've got some poor schnook, Sebastian Malaby, in the Financial Times, praising robo-traders, of course, because he wants to make sure he gets to the links on time. He doesn't want to miss his tea time. He doesn't want to have any kind of sentient thought passed from one neuron to another while he's drinking and slurping his third martini. So he just says the robo-traders down there on the floor buying and selling. And, of course, they're programmed to rape, pillage, and steal. But that doesn't seem to bother him so much, of course, because he doesn't even read the news anymore. I'm sure this last time Sebastian Malaby read the Financial Times was probably in 1987. Clearly anyone who's in praise of robo-traders would be dying to get a job as a guard at a concentration camp. That's the mentality we're talking about. And these people, of course, are adding enormous damage to society. And the Financial Times gives them space on their pages, I guess, as comic relief. It is kind of hilarious that somebody who is masking and parading around as offering some kind of balanced opinion on topics has this type of opinion. Shocking, of course, but so that's why I read the Financial Times. It's the comic book of our era.
That's right. So everybody liked the show with Eve Smith as a guest on the Kaiser Report. I recommend anybody out there who hasn't gone to maxkaiser.com this week to go check it out, because you talk about structural, the instability in financial markets, and that there's good equilibrium and bad equilibrium, and this is part of the ideology ruling the likes of Larry Summers and Timothy Geithner and Ben Bernanke, this sort of groupthink that there is no markets always tend to equilibrium. They can't, even if you manipulate them, they become equal, or you know, there's let the markets rule everything.
Well, it gets back to what we're saying at the beginning of the show. Now, the bankers, the central bankers, are talking about the need to restore faith in the system by engaging in massive amounts of the same fraud that destabled the system. That's not equilibrium. That's disequilibrium. The disequilibrium exists because bankers are buying back the bonds that they are selling at the same time that they're selling them. That's not a supply and demand driven capitalist system. That's a command and control, price fixing Soviet era communist system masquerading as an economy. And the results are the same. Unemployment is skyrocketing. The living standards are deteriorating. And the governments are engaging in warfare to try to reduce the global population, so because they fear someone's going to cut into their caviar allotment.
Yeah, but the thing is that so these heads of these various banks and organizations around the world, from the central banks to the BIS, to the IMF, to the World Bank, they are able to you know, they create this disequilibrium, this bad equilibrium, by manipulating markets, and the price will return to where it needs to go or where it's supposed to be. But because they create so many dams and artificial constructs of manipulation in that whole market, it's very chaotic, which always benefits the insiders and the very close to the power of the politicians, as we saw with the financial collapse. It was the Charlie Mungers of the world who, thank God, God willing, are saved by the politicians. The little people aren't. But they're the ones that are able to create those sort of huge chaotic moments that only they win during those moments.
Well, when you talk about a return to equilibrium, it's important to specify over what time scale one is referring to. Now, I see a return to equilibrium over a 15 to 20,000 year time scale, where humans are afraid of nature as they had been for millions of years, because nature rules and man is just a speck on the earth and is ruled by the rules of nature. And this is what gave rise, of course, to ritual, and which gave rise to religion. But then religion gave rise to science through the back door of alchemy, and then science decided it was bigger than nature, and we've had a 500-year slump into premature human extinction as a result.
So what else do you want to talk about then, honey? We've got 10 more minutes.
Well, let's see. Just looking at the paper... of course, you've got more shenanigans happening in Japan. This is interesting because Tokyo doesn't know what to do with the fact that its currency keeps going up, 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 up. And underneath the surface, of course, one of the biggest reasons is because China is driving the price of the yen higher as a direct currency assault. And this is the beginning of an era of the currency wars. World War III fought in the currency pits. It's a very interesting chapter, I think.
Yes, well, also Switzerland spent billions of euros driving the price, driving the euro down in order to drive the dollar up, because Switzerland wanted their currency to not be a safe haven. Germany was very happy with the 120 range of the euro. The U.S. is intervening in the currency market. Brazil announced apparently yesterday that they're going to intervene in the currency market. So, yeah, this is This is the round two. This is the round of the first Great Depression that really got things heading to global world war. This is what triggers it.
Yeah, this is interesting. Now, in previous global world wars, it was very on the ground, physical battle for territory. During this recent period, with the accumulation of hundreds of trillions of dollars with the derivatives that are unwinding, it's going to be a war fought with futures contracts. As Buffett himself called them, weapons of mass financial destruction. That was not just a cute little metaphor. That's an accurate description of these derivative contracts, these highly leveraged, highly liquid derivatives contracts that can be used to destabilize economies around the world. And so Japan is being attacked by China over the currency markets because they're trying to keep the value of the Japanese yen as high as possible to make it hard for Japanese to export. The United States is trying to jawbone its currency lower, but without, of course, it's in a different position because it is the world reserve currency. And if it gets too low, then again, China would be encouraged to dump their massive U.S. dollar holdings that they accumulated selling junk to Americans through Walmart. And of course, that would spike long-term interest rates in the U.S. to the point of capsizing the already unstable real estate market. And so they have to be, kind of tread a fine line there. And then you've got other players in all this competitive devaluation of one's own currency to try to export your way out of this deflationary spiral. They can't all be winners. They're all going to be losers against the only thing that makes any sense in this environment, gold. Gold is now making new highs again. We've been saying on this show for 5 years that the gold has, I think, gone up five times since we told you to start buying it. We told you, don't buy a house, buy gold. Had you followed our advice, you'd be sitting on a huge fortune, basically, and no liabilities in the form of a house. And the story going forward is that gold, in British pounds term, will be up another 500% over the same period of time. It's simply on an upward arc that's unstoppable at this point. And we haven't even seen the panic buying emerge that will emerge once the public starts buying gold. Right now, you've got banks, central banks, hedge funds. The public is really, despite claims that it's the public is in there buying gold, that's not true. Less than 1% of the global investable assets is in gold bullion around the world. If that number goes to 5%, 10%, as it will, you're talking about gold trading $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 an ounce quite easily. And of course, that's exactly where it's going. And for the reasons that we've been saying now for 5 years, I mean, if you had followed our advice, it would outperform every asset class, every exchange, every money manager in the world.
Well, here's another interesting story, because this show has been kind of depressing. Here's a more kind of a entertaining story to end the this show. The Chinese are hoarding a new commodity that's become even more expensive than gold. So the New York Times had an intriguing story on the skyrocketing price of jade in China. According to the article, the demand for jade among China's newly rich appears to have reached a frenzy in the past year or two. The price of the finest jade has increased tenfold over the past decade to $3,000 an ounce, making it far more valuable than gold. So they go on to say that, you know, unlike gold, which can be melted down, each single piece of jade is unique. And they're trying to determine why so many people are buying jade. And it's for the same reasons, really. The channeling of China's savings into stores of value like gold or vacant real estate that are themselves unproductive but offer people a place to stash their cash, give a limited choice of alternatives. So, you know, so also when China's government stepped in to cool the property market, what happened is everybody went into gold and jade, apparently, because the price of jade has increased by 50% in the past few months alone. And it also, it's part of the tax evasion in China by these middle and upper classes. So they're apparently the wealthy Chinese have $1.5 trillion in hidden income, accounting for over 30% of GDP. And using portable, non-traceable assets like gold and jade are an ideal form of storing such gains. So that's part of the reason. That's one of the suggestions I came up with of the surge of physical buying of gold, especially through Switzerland. At the very same time that the U.S. was going after those UBS accounts, there was that purchase of something like 1,000 Krugerrands or 10,000 Krugerrands. I was thinking it has to be those people taking their money out of the banks, their secret bank accounts there, and just buying it. They don't care what price they paid for it. They just needed to get it out and bury it in the backyard.
Right. That's an excellent point, because what's driving the price is not inflation. What's driving the price is lack of supply.
And collapse. A collapse in global economy.
Deflation.
And what brings that down with it is political systems. So
that's deflation.
Anybody who is around or knows history knows that when systems collapsed in the 1920s to 1940s, you wanted, it doesn't matter what you get, but you take whatever you can and find safety.
Right. The point is that when you rotate out of one asset to another, that's not inflation. That's not, you're not creating capacity. You're not creating an expansion of GDP. You're just rotating amongst your asset classes. The rotation into gold and jade is not because of inflation. It's because of deflation. Okay, that's the key point that people have to wrap their mind around. This is why people say, well, how can gold go up during deflation? How can jade go up during deflation? Because it's going up due to this rotation amongst asset classes, not because there's a surfeit of money sloshing around the system chasing goods and services and jobs. For inflation, you would need expansion of money supply, velocity of money, higher wages, and overall a couple of other factors which simply are not present in the current system. It's the exact opposite.
Well, that's all we have time for this week on The Truth About Markets, Resonance 104.4 FM. If you haven't visited resonancefm.com and donated some money recently, maybe you should go there and do that. Make sure we keep this radio station on air.
Yeah, that's right. Cash in one of your massively valued gold coins and give the money to Resonance 104.4.
Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.